Funding for Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer is provided by the Foundation at Hearst Castle, where donors and members experience exclusive events that recreate what it was like to be a guest of William Randolph Hearst, from swimming in the iconic Neptune Pool to dining in Hearst's private guesthouse overlooking the Pacific Ocean. The Foundation at Hearst Castle's ongoing mission is to support the conservation and restoration of Hearst Castle while offering youth programs for underserved students. Discover how you can become a member by going to foundation@hearstcastle.com and learn how you can support this unique and invaluable mission.
I'm your host, Tom Wilmer, reporting from Templeton, California. Come along and join me for a conversation with Vic Roberts, the owner of Victor Hugo Winery off of El Pomar Road. You've been here as a grower, producer, for what, since the 80s?
I first arrived in Paso Robles in 1982. Startup winery, needed a winemaker general manager, and I was a 79 UC Davis graduate, so I had 3 years under my belt, and with that massive, rather paper-thin resume, I convinced I was perfect.
And you went work out in Crest?
It was first Creston Manor, then Creston Vineyards, but right on Highway 58, almost out to Shell Creek Road, southeast corner of the Paso Robles AVA.
And then at some point, you decided to go for it, and you have, what, 80 acres?
Just shy of 80. In 1984, my wife Leslie and I decided to buy an old, fairly run-down abandoned cattle ranch, little farmhouse that needed to be remodeled multiple times before we could live here. Redwood barn that was rather rough, circa 1900, hadn't been used for anything except a little bit of storage and forever. Mountains of junk everywhere, so no vines on the property. When we purchased it in 84, we planted our first vines in 1985.
Was there a learning curve? Did you make some mistakes?
Oh, you know, everybody makes some mistakes. Our single biggest mistake planting here was the fact that the closest vineyard to us at the time was Wild Horse, which is about a mile and a half away, straight line. Wild Horse didn't have a deer fence, so we said, well, we don't need a deer fence. Well, we soon learned that that was not the right answer. We appeared to be in what was a major deer travel pattern, and you know, when deer feed, they return night after night and follow the exact same pattern, and they actually carved out a swath through the vineyard where they ate the green shoots so often the vines no longer would put out shoots. They killed them, basically. Yeah, so one of the first revisions was to hire someone to put up a deer fence. So we actually had to more or less wing it, you know, just a lot of hours spent on weekends and after work in the vineyard here to try to get it where it needed to be. Finally, once we had our first crop in 89, then the farm credit would take a serious look at it. So that was the...
That helped you.
That was definitely a bonus. Mm-hmm.
Talk about planting and what you have now and how long it took you to go to the full.
After the first section paid for itself, we didn't plant any more until 93, and then we planted a fair amount between 93. The last planting was 2000, or the last change in the footprint. Subsequently, we've done some small removals and changed varieties in a couple blocks, but we're still sitting at just over 78 acres. So we planted originally what would sell, because it was a vineyard only at that point. So we planted Chardonnay, which, knock on wood, we've never had unsold Chardonnay in the entire time we've had the vineyard. Then some of the later plantings, once there was the inkling that we should branch out, the first red we planted was Zinfandel, very traditional for Paso Robles. And then once there was the idea that it might eventually be a winery in the future, we started planting some of the varieties that we thought we would be producing here at the winery. 97, we took the plunge, gave up the day job, eventually refurbished the circa 1900 Redwood barn, became the winery, and
processing the whole time.
We did the first couple of crushes off-site and then brought the wines over here when they were ready to be bottled. Then the winery here was in full production by 99. Mm-hmm. Subsequently have expanded the winery slightly, but the building itself is self-limiting, and that's been our focus, that we're only going to make the amount of wine that we can produce in this facility, store the barrels in this facility, case goods, the whole thing, bring in a mobile bottle or bottle it right on site. So the wine never leaves here until it goes home with the consumer or goes on a truck to one of our distributors.
But you do sell some round grapes to others.
Yes, we do. Yeah. Actually, most of the original planting, the Chardonnay, is sold every year. Occasionally, we'll make a little bit for the wine club. Generally speaking, all of the Chardonnay, and then, you know, small lots of some of the reds, mostly to, you know, some of the smaller producers in the area, people we've known for a while. And we also have the luxury of crushing all of the fruit here, selecting the best for us, and then sometimes selling the extra.
I don't want to sidetrack too much, but you talked to me before about négociants.
Yes.
And talk to us just for a moment about that and how that world works.
Generally speaking, is driven by two factors, supply and demand and the economy, mm-hmm. which, of course, become interrelated because wine is, even though you and I might think it's essential, it is a luxury item. In years with surplus fruit and wine, there generally are négociant brands that may never own grapes, a vineyard, a property, a winery, mm-hmm. they simply will put together wines from wines that are available, come up with a concept, a brand.
Négociant might come and meet with you and purchase the wine, right?
That is possible. Yes, mm-hmm. absolutely.
Absolutely. And so it's possible that a $2 chuck could wind up with some $30 a bottle wine in it.
It happens. No, it's, so it is definitely a supply and demand part of the business. And, you know, négociants, when there is more inventory than is selling at whatever prices wineries feel they need to sell it at, you know, it is an avenue for wineries and even vineyards sometimes will turn some of their unsold grapes into bulk wine, mm-hmm. and then they can deal with finding a négociant that will purchase and bottle the wine, or sometimes it's a cooperative effort between a grower and a marketing guru to put together a brand and then market it. It can be, you know, very small, targeted, you know, only California, or some of them, you know, launch national brands, but they're very price sensitive, mm-hmm. and small fluctuations in grape and bulk wine prices will determine whether the négociant's brand will continue to sell. So if they can't source the product at the same price, they can't necessarily have a vintage where it's 25% more.
And the other dynamic is square footage, even in North County, where they warehouse and store wine, both bulk and bottle. Talk to us about that world for a moment.
There are, and I don't know what the latest figure is, but I'm going to say we're approaching 45,000 acres of grapes in the Paso Robles AVA, wine grapes. There are several large production facilities in the area, some of which are owned by wineries now that didn't start in Paso Robles, but now use a significant amount of Paso Robles fruit for some of their brands. And then a large volume of grapes from Paso Robles are still sold outside the area. Mm-hmm. So not all of the fruit grown here is crushed here. But, you know, definitely...
Some of the tanker trucks, the crushed...
Yes, either as grapes or they're turned into wine and then shipped as wine later under contract.
So they might wind up in Napa or Sonoma.
They could... Yes, absolutely. Absolutely.
That's one of the dirty little secrets.
Yeah, so...
Sonoma could buy 24% of their wine from you, put it in their bottle, and still label it as Sonoma.
Yes. So the way it works is it's, of course, it's, you know, complicated because some of these rules are somewhat archaic. You have multiple layers that you're dealing with as far as what goes on the label. So the most restrictive is estate, which means 100% of the fruit has to be grown by, crushed by, fermented, barrelage and bottled by the producer. And then you move down from there. The vintage date on a wine is 95% has to be, or more, has to be from that year. Mm-hmm. Moving down, then an established AVA, such as Paso Robles or Russian River Valley, is 85%. Uh-huh. And then the really strange thing is that if you use a county designation, such as San Luis Obispo County or Napa County or Sonoma County, mm-hmm. it only has to be 75% from that area.
Oh, interesting.
And then you have varietal. Mm-hmm. So if it says Cabernet Sauvignon, and this is anywhere in the United States, it has to be 75% or more varietal, uh-huh. which isn't always a bad thing. Mm-hmm. You know, quite often Cabernet benefits from having small amounts of Merlot or Cab Franc or other Bordeaux reds blended in. It's not always a sign that something is amiss when it's not 100%. In right. fact, quite often the wines are better. Mm-hmm. But the idea is that if you're not using an AVA and you're using a county designation, yes, you could buy up to 25% mm-hmm. or 24.9% from outside your area.
This is going way back in time, but when I was working on the Livermore wine book, one of the producers was telling me that Napa wines, oftentimes their reds are tannicky, and they like the Livermore reds to blend in because they're softer. And that's part of the mission, right?
You know, ultimately, wine is supposed to be something that is enjoyed by the consumer as, at least in my opinion, as part of the meal. I mean, it's not a separate item, it's part of the meal. And
well, going back in time, you died if you drank the water.
That's true. In fact, that's, you know, the idea of putting wine into the water to help sterilize it was, you know, also done. But the concept of, is my wine the biggest, most powerful wine that possibly could be made? Is that the goal? It shouldn't be, because those wines are quite often unbalanced and clumsy and don't age well and also don't complement food, which is the whole point. They're meant to be a part of the meal. So if your wines are extremely tannic, buying fruit or wine from another region that has the wines have great fruit and structure, but not the tannins. Mm-hmm. It's a bonus. You know, people are always concerned about how it's going to be perceived. Ultimately, it's about putting the best wine in the bottle.
Yeah. But again, you hit a home run, because in the old country, you would not drink without food, and you would not have food without drink.
Right.
Therefore, I always question when people try to judge a wine, and you give them crackers or cheese, you know, well, how about, I'm in Carmel Valley, and the chef brings me out a Merlot, and it was okay. Then he brought me a slice of venison, and the Merlot just exploded because of that flavor balancing.
No, absolutely. So, you know, that's another whole skill set, and that's what the best chefs all know how to do. Mm-hmm. You know, they'll taste the wines and then come up with pairings, and it is a very special skill set. You know, a few winemakers can do a version of the opposite. Well, here's my wines. I know foods that complement them, and I can make suggestions. But the actual, you know, pairing, particular for a you know, multicultural dinner, is it's an amazing skill set.
You know, I spent time in Scotland, single malt. I asked about whiskey tastings, and they said, well, we don't have tastings. We have what we call nosings, because more so than any other noble spirit or any other liquor or whatever, whiskey is a total olfactory experience. In extrapolating, the experience of properly savoring wine has everything to do with that bouquet and that sniffing and smelling, right?
Oh, I agree with you completely.
Can you talk about that for a moment?
Well, in fact, you were commenting on wine judgings, and wine judging in general are very difficult to do. I judged for probably 15 years at various points at various competitions, Orange County Fair, Riverside, some of the local events here, and you are tasting a tremendous amount of wines in a short period of time, because that you're just limited. You can't do three wines a day for 3 weeks. Fatigue is a huge issue, palate fatigue. But actually, the ability to smell the wines does not fatigue nearly as quickly as your palate does to taste the wine. So for me, generally speaking, there are very few wines, if I don't find them aromatically interesting, that I'm going to score the wine very high. Mm-hmm. I mean, they might be a fine, sound wine, yeah. But, you know, when you're doing wine judgings, you're looking for wines that, in addition to being sound, are interesting or exciting or have that balance and complexity that, you know, makes, sets them apart. But definitely the idea that you can evaluate a lot more wines through senses, through sense of smell, than you can through your palate.
Vic Roberts, we're out of time, but I'm going to hunt you down again for part two.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
To learn more about your world, online presence?
Yes, you can visit victorhugowinery.com. We have a website, describes our wines, the property, tasting policies, when we schedule appointments, etc.
I'm your host, Tom Wilmer, reporting from Templeton, California, where we've been visiting with wine grower and producer Vic Roberts at Victor Hugo Winery.
Funding for Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer is provided by the Foundation at Hearst Castle, where donors and members experience exclusive events that recreate what it was like to be a guest of William Randolph Hearst, from swimming in the iconic Neptune Pool to dining in Hearst's private guest house overlooking the Pacific Ocean. The Foundation at Hearst Castle's ongoing mission is to support the conservation and restoration of Hearst Castle while offering youth programs for underserved students, preserving the past and inspiring future generations of dreamers. These children experience a world of science, technology, engineering, art, and math at Hearst Castle, STEAM, along with studying the legacy of Julia Morgan, one of the most important women in the history of engineering and architecture. The Foundation at Hearst Castle not only changes the lives of children, but also provides lifetime memories and unrivaled experiences for our generous donors and members. Discover how you can become a member by going to foundationathearstcastle.com and learn how you can support this unique and invaluable mission. You've been listening to the Lowell Thomas Award-winning travel show Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer, a featured podcast on NPR.org's podcast directory. You are invited to subscribe to Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer on NPR.org, NPR One, iTunes, Stitcher.com, and more than 20 other podcast channels around the world. To learn more about Tom Wilmer's journeys around America and the world, log on to thomaswilmer.com.
This is Roseanne Cash, and I'm sitting here with Tom Wilmer. Please support your local NPR station. I listen to WNYC in New York, and in fact, NPR is all I listen to. If I didn't have NPR, I would feel like my lifeline to the world has been cut. So, yes, please support your local NPR station.